When the matchmaker came to my grandfather to try to make a match between my father and mother. Well, they talked and they talked, but they didn't agree until someone produced a bottle of whiskey. Then they drank and they sang and they danced and they reeled. And in the morning when they woke up, the deer was sealed.
Hello out there, folks. This is the New Yiddish Rap Radio Hour, the radio program that nobody listens to, and it gives us the opportunity to say whatever we like to whomever we like. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Michael Lenegrad.
Hello.
He is a wonderful musician, clarinetist, klezmer artist, and we're going to ask him about some of his recent work, his plans, his concert series here in Brooklyn at the Temple Beth Emeth, from which this broadcast is originating. We just did the Yiddish Shylock here this afternoon. We did a reading of Jacob Adler's Yiddish Shylock. We reprised it for the folks in Brooklyn. And tonight there is going to be a concert by Frank London, a brass quartet, I'm told, that he has put together just for this evening. And if Michael has some time, I'd like to ask Michael, what's up? What are you working on? What you been doing? And what's planned? And
what am I doing? I'm working on our new record that I'm going to record in September. And that's basically what I've been putting sort of all my, that's the basket I've been putting all my eggs into recently, spending a lot of time preparing and fundraising and practicing and writing and rehearsing and all that fun stuff. And also working on this series here and then just some little things here and there.
I'm curious, how many years have you been into the klezmer music?
Yeah. So I was 14 years old.
And was this the first genres that really grabbed you that you decided?
I think so. I think that I came to it through sort of avant-garde jazz because a lot of the musicians in New York at the time in the mid-90s were exploring Jewish music through that medium. And so I was really into that, but I think that klezmer was the first one that I got really serious about as a musician, as an instrumentalist, as a, you know, a participant.
And what opportunities did you have at that time to play out, to meet other klezmer musicians? What was the scene at that
when
time?
When I started, I was 14, and I went to klez camp in Catskills. And that's basically where it all began. I studied with Sid Beckerman there, which was amazing. And then 75%. I always say that Sid Beckerman taught me 75% of what I know about klezmer, and since then I've learned the other 25%.
Tell us, are people who aren't listening who he is?
All of you. he unfortunately died a couple years ago, but he was one of the last of his generation in terms of clarinetists, and he was lived in Brooklyn forever. His father was one of the great recorded clarinetists of the earlier part of the century in the 1920s and 30s. Amazing recordings of his father, Shlomka Beckerman. But then the sort of, he learned from his father, was never too much of a professional musician, played weddings, I think, but then basically stopped and was a mailman for 40 years, no one heard from him. And then when the whole klezmer revival started up again in the 70s and they started klez camp, Pete Zocco, who's a pianist, who has played with him, said, oh, this guy, we should get him back playing again. And so they brought him, and he is unbelievable, the most, so giving, he wanted to share everything that he knew, and that was what was amazing about him. And I was so fortunate that he was teaching then, and he was on his game. Like, when I got there, it was such a great time to study with him, and he was so enthusiastic about my learning. And so I got to study with him there when I think for 3 years. And so I was pretty young, and that's where I basically met other people, and there were other people my age playing the music. From there on.
What attracted you to the clarinet?
Well, I wasn't playing clarinet at the time. I was playing saxophone at the time.
Ah.
And I don't know, it's a saxophone. It's a cool instrument. You know, they started me in third grade. They started me off on clarinet, but only because I wanted to play sax. I said, third grade, you can do clarinet. And then when you get to fourth grade, then you go with the saxophone. So with saxophone, I forgot about the clarinet until I started going to Klez camp. From the first 2 years, I just played sax. And I remember I was at a master class. David Krakauer was giving a master class in the city. And he told me, he says, if you want to play klezmer, you should learn the clarinet. So I asked my other friend, who also quit the clarinet in third grade, who was living around the block from me, said, hey, do you still have that clarinet that you used in the third grade band when we were in it together? And because I just got a saxophone, I just borrowed a clarinet. And said, yeah, I think it's in my garage. So we dug it up and I bought it for $35 and I had my first clarinet. And that $35 clarinet is a lot cheaper than the clarinet that I play now. So that's how the clarinet started.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was with someone, and we passed Beethoven pianos. And we went in, and we were looking on the first floor. They have all these grands. And we were looking, and I'm looking at the pianos. They're $55,000, $58,000. So the fellow I was with said, oh, this is relatively cheap. Pound for pound, pianos are a bargain. If you were a violinist, then you'd really have to spend money.
Oh, my God,
money.
Right, I know.
Is that the same with clarinets?
Who knows? You know, I have a custom-built clarinet that I play now. Brilliant, experimental, weirdo, freaky, cool, crazy clarinet builder lives in Toronto. And he built me this clarinet. That's really cool and weird and different. And, I mean, pricey, yes, especially for a poor musician who can't afford anything. However, comparatively, it's in the same price range as, you know, like a professional model of, one of the better, more popular brand name clarinets. So it's not super, there's ones that are definitely more expensive. And yes, if you compare it to the equivalent of its kind in of a cello or a violin, yeah, or a bass, they're going to be way more expensive. You know, it's like, it's maybe a fourth or a fifth as much as my roommate's bass, you know, and that's not even one of the top basses. Yeah, I mean, so it's like, it's all relative.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the whole revival of klezmer.
Okay.
And what, in your, when did it start? And in what, in your opinion, was the cause, what were the causes of this?
Well, it's interesting. So I'm not the best person to ask this because I came in 20 years into it, right? Mm-hmm. I came into it when it wasn't really reviving anymore. It had been revived.
Uh-huh.
So having said that, I can tell you what my thoughts are. So when did it start was one of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly mid-70s. Okay. Why did it start? Loaded question. There were a lot, number one, in a completely un-Jewish context, right, non-Jewish context,
right,
there's a lot of revivals of folk musics, folk dance musics, right, Eastern European folk, right, musics that were happening.
Right.
Starting some years before that, but, you know, Balkan music and Romanian music, all this related music to it. And so this fit into that. Other reason is, well, we know that klezmer was killed along with, well, not killed, but to sleep, along with a lot of other Jewish culture after the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it needed some time because, you know, the whole Yiddish thing, the whole secular Jewish thing related to that needed, well, didn't necessarily need it, but it took its time because it was, you know, it was painful, you know, and it needed to rest. However, people talk about how folks are into what their grandparents were into, and things skip a generation, and I think there was a void for a number of people. I don't know, I wasn't there, but I imagine that there was a void for a number of people, because there's great Jewish art music. Klezmer music is an amazing art form. Cantorial music is unbelievable, which still hasn't gone through a revival, and now only really exists regularly in the Hasidic world, you know? But these are incredible forms of music that are deep, that are you know, really meticulous, you know, really technical musics that are very interesting both to listeners and to musicians. And I think people weren't getting that out of what had been the Jewish musics that were happening at the time. And there was so many people started discovering this stuff, you know, and they wanted to play it. You know, what can you say, you know?
I have this, and maybe you can... inform me or educate me about this. I have this pet peeve, and it's rooted in the fact that apparently Germany played a big role in diffusing the revival of Yiddish music by producing a lot of German record companies produced klezmer and were very active in
it. You mean during the revival?
Yes, during the revival.
Well, it wasn't so much the records, but what it really was the concerts. Germany, and it still is, not to the extent that it was, but still is one of the premier, if not second to the United States, before the United States, you know, like the premier place to play klezmer because it's profitable to do so there. I'll talk about first what happened was, you know, this revival happened, you know, the first couple places where it happened were, you know, New York and San Francisco and Philadelphia. Right after that is Berlin. There were bands that that started playing as early as 1981, which is early. That's before it happened well before it happened in Israel, I'll tell you that, you know, there was a number of reasons. I think some people are coming in. All right. I'm going to catch up with you later on.
We got to let Michael go to take care of some business here. Frank London is going to be performing, and there he is. Hey, Frank, you're on the radio.
What are you doing here?
I'm doing my radio show. We did Shylock this afternoon here.
Did you?
Yeah. So, Frank London, the man himself of the Klezmatics.
Hi.
Say hello. And goodbye. They're going to set up for their 7 o'clock concert. And we are going to make an attempt to get a hold of another guest. And let me see if I can get a hold of her, if possible. You know, I'm always a bit puzzled by Skype and how to go about doing these things. But I'm going to try and get a hold of Tova, who recently premiered in Philadelphia a new show that she co-wrote and that she stars in. I am told that it was sensational. I had a bit of a mishap trying to get over there to see it. And it really bugged the hell out of me. But it turned out we were on our way and we just couldn't make it for one reason or another, which I won't go into. I was told that it was just a tour de force, and I'm hoping that she will be able to produce it again, and if I can get a hold of her, we'll talk to her about that. I'm just bumbling around now trying to find how to get there, and while I do, I'm going to play some music and see if I can't get her on the horn. So here we go. We'll go back to this whiskey song that I played at the intro. And see you in a minute.
When the matchmaker came to my grandfather to try to make a match between my father and mother, well, they talked and they talked, but they didn't agree until someone produced a bottle of whiskey. Then they drank and they sang and they danced and they reeled.
All righty. We're back.
Yeah.
And here I am with Baruch Thaler, recently graduated from the Columbia School of Film. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So, and I understand Tony Kushner was at your graduation.
Yeah.
We're talking about it. And he's been involved in a little bit of controversy lately with the City University. So what did he have to say, Tony?
Well, he didn't address the controversy directly.
Yeah.
Although the person who introduced him mentioned, gave a sort of a snide comment, to CUNY that since CUNY dropped him, so to speak, we have him. Although, I mean, Tony is a Columbia graduate of 78. So for him, it was more like a homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really congenial. He's a real mensch. And the way he spoke was just rolled off his tongue. It was just very discursive and full of meat, depth and humor. And we really everyone really responded.
Did he give you the impression of a raving anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist, self-hating, self-destructive Jew, or what impression did you have? I mean, that's how he's painted,
right?
By the a certain element of who disagree with him politically.
Well, he didn't mention anything political overtly. That he was focusing mainly on the whole function of art and what does it mean to be an artist in our day and age. And actually, he was all the more, he was actually being very proud of his Jewishness, throwing in Yiddishisms like Shepping Nachas and Shiva and things like that. And then, in fact, afterwards, I went over to him and spoke with him and actually asked him directly about how he identifies with his Jewish identity, and he was very open and proud that he still goes to Reform Shul, as he puts it, and he's still very committed to the way he sees his Jewish identity to be also not both affecting his art and as a social way to better the world. And then he was also interested about my Hasidic background and stuff like that.
So you had quite a conversation then.
Yeah, a bit, yeah. We also spoke about Arthur Miller and he's currently finishing putting together the Library of America's anthology of Arthur Miller's works. So that was really, and we were in the Miller Theater, so yeah. So it was almost a full circle.
You heard it here, folks. This is the radio program that nobody listens to, and you haven't been listening to it right here at New Yiddish Rep Radio. So Baruch was in the Shylock reading today and at YIVO. So what do you think? What did you think of the experience?
I mean, as being the second staged reading of the work, it felt smoother. It felt more almost, more embodied in the roles, less reference to the text, and just coming more from the inner self. And although it wasn't in the full grandiosity of YIVO as it was last time, still, there were other positive elements. Both the acoustics of the room were amazing.
Jeez, this is an amazing play room. Mm. And they're going to do a brass quartet in here. Mm. I don't know how anybody's going to be able to stand it.
Yeah. You're going to have to open the... It's going to shatter the stained glass windows.
I mean, even the smallest whisper is really bounces off them, that marble platform. And it's a great place to perform. Mm. What are your plans? What is it that you are going to... hopefully be doing in the future now that you've graduated? You got any projects that you can let us know about?
Well, some of them are still, as we say, not before being in the can, which is being in the head and being developed. Certainly in film, I have several scripts that are ready. Once we get all the right players in place, hopefully it'll be a go. I'm also involved in like consulting for theater and Broadway and for Jewish related works, and I'm also finishing up a new English translation of the Haggadah together with Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander. These are American Jewish writers. We're going out through the final layouts. Hopefully, we'll be ready for Passover 2012.
Passover 2012.
Yes.
So, who's illustrating it?
We have a multitude of different artists, and so it'll be very unique because.
And is this going to be a traditional translation of the traditional text, or is it going to be an experimental, hippie alternative? What are you going to do?
Well, it's being called the New American Haggadah. What's making it new is not that we're rewriting or reinventing the Haggadah, but we're taking the old vessel, the old container of what the words of the Haggadah, and we're infusing it with new, fresh approach to a more idiomatic English, more poetic way, not just blessed art thou God, blah, 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 but a way that will make us rethink clearer or see the whole this ancient text with through new lenses, and also in a way to be trans-denominational, to cover a way that both Orthodox, conservative, and even Reform will be comfortable with opening this Haggadah.
I see. You think that's possible? I mean, as you speak it, do you say to yourself, what am I saying?
Yeah. There was a certain approach we took. We started off with the middle of the road to see how it goes, and it's been experimental the last couple of years. And at this point, it's primarily Orthodox in the sense that we looked at the ways the conservative and reform Nusach versions veer from the Orthodox, and we've kept primarily to the Orthodox version. Then, in addition to that, there's some midrashic piece interpretations that the conservative Haggadah had added. So we added some of those too, but those are optional. So the Orthodox Nusach is in there, and then there's the option if anyone wants to add to that any of the more revised later Haggadah versions. So hopefully it will be something that all the four sons, all four American sons, from the wise to the wicked to the simple, and we won't say who is who, but everyone will be comfortable, all the sons will be comfortable together.
You have an interesting background yourself. I mean, you have an interesting formative experience of growing up Jewish. Part of it is Eastern, and part of it is Occidental, and what is it?
Oriental
and Occidental. How did that? How? What do you make of that now, as an adult looking back, and how did that affect you? And what?
This is stuff that I usually confess only to my imaginary therapist, like 2 a.m. in bed. But now that you brought it up, it's certainly. The very concept of identity. Is interesting, you know, that us and them, and having one parent from a more of a, yeah, from the Eastern point, you know, perspective, and one from here, it's kept me, at least personally, it's making me more tolerant to various perspectives, and also shows that really the boundaries that we create in society are by and large artificial in certain ways. I mean, just biologically, the fact that my mother and father could have cohabitated, as they used to say, and produced someone like myself, which seems to be from opposites. But look, it's real. We're human, and this is what makes us human, is that essential universalist human core that we all share, and that I learned from both my parents, how to respect both one's individuality and culture, and also to be open to the other. And it's also being raised in like an extreme Hasidic community on one end, and the other end being totally liberal and open. So that too.
How did that happen? How did you get to a Hasidic community? How did that come about?
Well, one answer. One word, 60s burnout. That was from my mother's side, at least, yeah. So after Yeah, after all the acid and SDS demonstrations wore off, a lot of young Americans started searching to other places. Other areas, so they started looking into Eastern spiritual paths. So, for example, my mother joined a Zen macrobiotic commune, which is where I was born, raised, more or less the first few years. And then at some point, they realized that their own religion, and all these Jewish, American, kids realized that, there's something called Kabbalah or Hasidus, that we have our own mystical tradition. And they embraced that, and before you knew it, this whole commune became what's known as Baal Tshuva. So they became returnees to traditional Judaism.
Well, your mother is now so orthodox that she will not touch men that are not related to her.
Correct.
Does she touch? Can she touch you?
She does. Yes. She's also unique because on one hand she will keep. She strictly retains her Hasidic path of life, yet once in a while, such as today's performance, she will venture out from her Brooklyn small, Crown Heights community and come out to, at least, it's her son, so performing, understandable. I don't think she would go out to Broadway just out of the wind, but... Yeah, so it was really means even more for her to come out to something like this. And also, she has her own artistic background, and she had an uncle who was prominent in New York Yiddish theater. So altogether, she identifies with it, even though her Yiddish is very alien to her. Even though her parents spoke, but she doesn't.
So where does yours come from?
It came from being raised in a Yiddish-speaking community and going to a yeshiva where everything was taught in Yiddish and we all spoke Yiddish. That was the natural language in that environment. For example, by the time of we were finishing eighth grade, out of a class of 30, I think I was the only one who knew how to read and write English. And that it wasn't even taught. I just picked it up.
And this is Lubavitch?
This is in Lubavitch. There was zero secular studies taught. That means not English, not mathematics, not science, nothing. Only the Bible, Talmud, and Jewish law, and Jewish mysticism. That's all. I think the last decade or two, it's become a little looser in the sense that the teachers in the yeshiva system will lapse into English. In my days, they would never speak English. So there has been a lessening of even Yiddish awareness within the Lubavitch community, but it's still there. And also the Rebbe would always speak in Yiddish. So just to understand the Lubavitch Rebbe, call him the Rebbe, we'd have to know the Yiddish just to follow. So all of that were facts.
By the way, that speaking of the Lubavitch Rebbe, that is not coming from the heavens, what you're hearing. That's the brass quartet warming up inside. Perhaps the Rebbe is listening, but it's not on his account that you're hearing
that. Mashiach, that's not the clarion calls of Mashiach revealing.
What was your, did you have any kind of relationship with the Rebbe? Did you have a personal relationship with him?
Somewhat. I had a couple private audiences with him when I was younger. And at some point, by the time of my bar mitzvah, they stopped. The Rebbe stopped having private audiences. However, he was part and parcel of my daily life, all prayers. I grew up right behind the main shul 770, and that is so. Every day, I would more than once a day, I would see the Rebbe and walk in the shul, walk out things, and during his main big gatherings, I had a place right near him underneath the table, and would. Especially on the holidays or Shabbos or Sabbath, you weren't allowed to record or write. Mm-hmm. So we would memorize what he was saying, and then after Sabbath, review it and record it. And get all of the.
Tell me, what were the private audiences like?
It was interesting. I mean, I did go in with some family members, but it was unique. I would say two things. First of all, that you saw at these audiences. One was his unique and His almost I wouldn't call it superhuman, but certainly, very advanced agility of speed of just reading. He took his whole page I wrote and others, like almost like scanning it and really knew everything and even was asking me things about what he just, you know, was reading. And the other was giving individual attention. That, you know, when he communicated to you, you had the sense that there was nothing else on his mind except you. So he had that unique talent. I mean, as much as there's critical aspects of maybe his ideology and other things, but he was, in some form or other, he was certainly a very unique person.
Was he a benign personality? Could you describe him as benign?
But how benign? Not benign in the boring sense, if that's what you mean.
No, I mean goodly. I mean benign in the sense of nurturing, because, you know, my impression of him was always, and I only had it from a real distance, really.
Yeah.
But my impression from him was that he, I don't quite know how to describe it, but if looks could kill, the Rebbe could drop you in a second. That was my, and that was my experience. I went for Brengen, I went to, where I was on the aisle when he was going up to the Umud, and he turned around and looked at me, and I looked right at him, and I had this chill came over me, like a cold chill came over me, and it wasn't like a feel-good feeling, you know? So I'm just curious as to...
That's a good point. People have always spoken about when they made either the eye contact or being in his presence and having different reactions. Most would have almost like a... you know, like almost celebratory approach. Oh, wow, like I was blown away, yada, yada. Others have, like the way you're describing it, you know, having almost, you know, almost out of, you know, being shot back rather than being drawn in. But what most people will say is that they, whether it was positive or negative, is that they were at least affected, that he had a sort of, you know, he touched something in them, some way, whatever that may be. And the rest is for us to work it out.
you know, it's interesting to be around figures like this. Zalman is coming.
Schachter.
What's his name?
Schachter. Zalman Shalomi Schachter. Yeah.
Shalomi Schachter is coming. And he is also someone who has a profound effect on people. And I've listened to a couple of his Skype lectures. Frankly, I don't personally know what to make of him. I'm not exactly sure. I know that the people coming to the lectures are very... you've been there.
Yeah.
How would you characterize him as a spiritual leader?
Right. Interesting. I've been in contact with him on and off over the last years. Actually, he also has, like you were mentioning, like sort of an ambivalent approach to the Rebbe, who is his own. He sees as his own master, actually the Rebbe's predecessor, his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who passed away in 1950, who was a saintly and activist and had a really impressive presence and all that. Rabbi Zalman himself is what he's been. His life's work seems to have been developing a way to bridge the ancient with the ultra-modern, taking aspects of not only limited to Judaism, but from all cultures and all spiritual paths, and bringing it through the prism of Judaism, and even developing, creating new forms of ritual practice. And he's very into davening and into praying. And what does that mean, to pray and to meditate and to be connected to something divine? So Reb Zalman is, first and foremost, one of the greatest believers in God I've ever encountered. He's not a heretic. On the other hand, the way he expresses his belief is viewed by traditional Judaism as heretical, because he's not into the halacha, Jewish law. It's not that he's against halacha, but he sees as halacha in itself can be sometimes an impediment to higher service, and also, you know, bringing in from other religions is also seen as something that is that is anathema to traditional.
You know, he looks, he has the look of a straight ahead.
He trims his beard and he has, I would say he has more of a Jewish guru look in the sense, I saw years ago they had someone made a short film called The 70 Faces of Reb Zalman. And they went through all these images throughout the decades that taken of Reb Zalman and as a montage with some music. And you just saw how he evolves. He's almost, I won't call it chameleon, but certainly he likes his at least the way he appears, he likes to express himself based on the moment.
Is that a tuba?
It certainly is.
All right. Yeah. We got a tuba coming into the house.
Yeah, brass and all.
You know, the thing about Zalman is, well, you know, people like to mention, and I guess I'll mention it too, that he was, you know, did a lot of drugs. He did a lot of hallucinogens, and he liked the parties.
I wouldn't say party. It was more. One thing is, I don't think he was outside of his Jewish identity. Of course, Purim or Simchas Torah, he would party.
No, I just meant that he was open. He liked the ladies.
Yeah, he was certainly open, but it was also the time, and he was. It seems like he was doing it from an honest point of really trying to find that pintle of truth, that real essence. One of the reasons he was actually ostracized from Lubavitch and the traditional community was for an article that he printed in commentary to show how psychedelics could open up the Jewish community to new further ways of spiritual worship.
That's pretty radical.
Yeah.
But how do you think he views himself today? And how do you think the Jewish community views him today, the traditional Jewish community?
It's hard to gauge fully. I mean, because the very traditional community wouldn't really even know that he exists because they don't know anything outside of Borough Park and Williamsburg. But let's say in Lubavitch, where some in Lubavitch, because he came from Lubavitch, so he's almost like he's like the heretic within Lubavitch. And the thing is that he's already in his higher 80s, and he's like been there. You know, he's lived for so long, and he's still around. And like I even once in a while run to his former classmates in his 80s or their children, and he's still spoken of with intrigue. Even when I grew up and when I was Lubavitch with that, they would talk about Zalman quietly, this and that. One of the things was, for example, that supposedly the Rebbe's main secretary, Rabbi Charikov, said that there are different types of spies or people who pass on information. So you have spies who don't give out their identity, yada yada. But then the best one is the one he himself doesn't even know he's a spy, and he's giving passing it. So like Zalman, because he's out there in like he was out there in like San Francisco in the 60s or Colorado Boulder where he's now, or going to visit with the Dalai Lama and all that. So he's espousing all of these beautiful teachings. But to places where the Lubavitchers and Crown Heights would never venture, would never go. Some say the whole Chabad House movement was like a reaction to Zalman and Shlomo Carlbach's type of outreach in the 60s in California and stuff.
I have to say to those people not listening that this guy has a mind that is hard to... It's hard to really for a normal person like myself to understand the guy who has a mind that is so all-encompassing. I mean, this guy can talk about virtually anything, and not just talk about it, but talk about it from the basis of research and knowledge. I mean, physics, I don't think there's a subject that you could name that this guy does not have some level of expertise on. So it's hard to... you know, when you look at the guy and say, what do you say? Well, I ask myself, what do I think of this guy? And try to form an impression of him. That's actually hard. It's an impediment to me.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not sure I'm being clear about it. But the guy is so brilliant. His head is so full of information that often I'm not exactly sure how to react to him.
Mm.
But one thing I did want to ask you about is the last time I saw a lecture by him, he characterized his mission as a mission directed at believer at the religious community.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that interesting. Mm. I found it, and I also didn't know what to make of it somehow. How you doing?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because we usually think of, like, Jewish outreach.
Michael, do you need this table right now?
Soon.
All right, whatever.
We really usually think of Jewish outreach as being like a one-way outlet, that people from the religious or you know, Orthodox community, like the Lubavitchers, going out to assimilated Jews and reaching out to them to bring them back to Yiddish. It seems like Zalman is almost attempting, or in his own way, going from as one who was in the inside, went outside, or I don't even think he would define it that way, but let's just, for simplicity, define it in those crass ways of inside, outside, but or at least he's been exposed to other ways he wants to bring back those riches, those treasures that the typical, you know, ultra-religious Jew would not be exposed to, whether it is all those encyclopedic subjects that you mentioned, physics, and so he's also really into, like, computer science. Like, he uses metaphors of the virtual world or software for things. He even gives the classes on Skype, which, you know, he's very... So he's really... even though he's in his 80s, it's not like he's living in the past. He's very aware of the present. And I honestly had things to talk to him. I mean, I asked him certain questions, things like having to do with 2012 or certain cultural things that are happening now in the world. And he was very, very keen on talking, addressing it. He wasn't just like going down memory lane. Oh, back in the 60s when we were having, yeah, such great times.
What do you think? Does he still drop acid once in a while?
He never told me or directly, or I haven't heard from anyone else that he still does. I don't think he does.
Uh-huh.
My suspicion is that he's gone through it in the past, and he feels like he now has enough to take with him. Interestingly enough, there's an essay based on a lecture he gave to the American Association of Rabbis in sometime in the 60s, an essay comparing and contrasting his own acid trip, his first acid trip with Timothy Leary, with the Baal Shem Tov's Ascent of the Soul that he writes about. Baal Shem Tov has a whole letter where he describes having Aliyat HaNeshama, a rising ascent of the soul to the chamber of the Messiah, and what that was like. So that was also, so he was comparing the two trips. And ultimately his conclusion was that that LSD or psychedelics, while it is really amazing and rewarding for the moment, but it's not everlasting, that you come down from the trip. And then it won't necessarily be, it could be innerly somewhat transformative, but it's not guaranteed to be everlasting and to change the person totally. Whereas the Baal Shem Tov, when he went up and he came back down, he became the trend. So it's not like he's just saying, oh, how amazing, great. Let's just all, like Leary was saying, let's trip and drop out.
So he actually dropped acid with Leary?
Yes, he has a whole long essay. If you see Ralph Metzner's, he has an anthology, came out in the 60s, called...
yeah, we're on the radio.
Yeah, it's
hey, Amy.
Oh, it's called the Ecstatic Adventure.
Uh-huh.
So in there is like a bunch of very interesting essays, and you look it up. The Ascent of the Soul is one long essay by Zalman all about this, and in fact, it loops back to his experience with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. If you want to hear it, do you want to hear this? There's two vignettes. One is he says in the story itself, which incidentally I confirmed by finding the actual recording, which was sometime I think in '63. The Rebbe. Okay, so this is how Zalman is writing how he's traveling to meet up with Timmy up in where he had that place, Milburn or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Up in Massachusetts. Yeah. And how he's going. And then as he's traveling, he remembers that a few weeks beforehand, when he was at a Fabringen, the gathering of the Rebbe, The Rebbe asked for him specifically, asked where he is, and when he did, he showed up. The Rebbe told him to say one l'chaim for the retreat, and then another l'chaim for the meditation. And he saw that as almost the Rebbe's, sort of giving him, although not sanctioning in positively what he's doing, but at least giving him a certain, in some form, a blessing. And I actually found that recording, which is available online, where the Rebbe is even more in detail, like making, almost poking fun at Zalman. Like, the Rebbe goes, "We're Hillel director Zalman Shachter." He must have been like a Hillel director then before. He says, "Was he here?" He says, so he, apparently they couldn't find him right away.
All stuff Yiddish?
Yeah. He says no. So then the Rebbe says, "Oh, Mistama, he's still meditating somewhere. Maybe he's still at his retreat." So then they finally find Zalman, and then the Rebbe says, "Oh, say l'chaim, one for the retreat, and then one for the meditation." Okay, and then it's a really interesting read, all about the actual trip with Timmy. Then the second vignette, this I heard from the Rebbe's secretary himself, Rebbe Groner, that that Zalman Shachter called up to ask the Rebbe for a blessing to go on, because it's traditional, the tradition is before a chassid goes on a long travel, that they write to the Rebbe for a blessing. So he calls into the Rebbe's office asking, telling that he wants to write to the Rebbe for a blessing that he's going on a trip. So the Rebbe's secretary asks Zalman, "Where are you going?" So he replies, "I don't know where I'm going. All I know is I'm going on a trip." So the secretary says, "Zalman, what do you mean you don't know where you're going?" So then Zalman explained to him there's such a thing that just came out called LSD, yada, 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 yada. So the secretary told him, "Listen, Zalman, du bist gut beschugen, Kopf. I can't write into the Rebbe about all this to give you a blessing for a good trip, but I could write a blessing to the Rebbe because there's another form of blessing when someone's not well to ask for a refuah shleima, for health, that they should be complete recovery. So I write into the Rebbe that it should not affect your head. Zal nishatnin kopf." And that's what he did. And he got a blessing for that. So you know, as they say, great masters and leaders, even though this is another form of where he's like, he's being the shliach there without even being knowing that he is being out there as the shliach.
So I find it incredible that he actually asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe for a blessing because he was going on an acid trip. Did I understand this right?
Yes.
That's the depth of it.
Yeah.
He was going on
a
trip.
He was a chassid. And he wanted. And he wanted.
Say
you want to come out? We're on the live radio now. We're recording it.
Yeah.
It's a weekly radio. This is actually Eli. Do you want to say?
You, pardon?
Okay.
Oh, okay. Sure. I didn't realize we were disturbing you.
Is it cheaper to get
this? So yeah. So this is actually the portable radio show here.
Yeah, we can. I think we're all right here.
Okay,
we can just hang here.
Good.
I don't want to lose this.
Here, everything comes out. You know?
I don't want to lose the signal.
Okay.
Okay. So, well, we're just about done. We got about 8 minutes left.
Right.
And as I said, first, let's tell people that we are about to. There's a concert about to start with Frank London and a brass quartet here at Temple Beth Emes. It's a series that is curated by Michael Winograd and a wonderful klezmer musician that was on the show earlier. And this happens every other Sunday here, and we are also in residence here with the new Yiddish Repertory Theater. So, when did you yourself actually leave Lubavitch?
You mean at least externally? I mean, part of me has never left, but but I would say like in the mid '90s, in an open, full way. Yeah, I mean, it was a gradual, introspection to a certain point. You know, whether it was, ideologically or emotionally and whatever, but then the actual, getting away from the community fully was, maybe 95 or so.
But yeah. You go back occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, I have family there, so I still have to go. I don't appear to be a chassid, or I don't even view myself as being fully from in the traditional sense, but part of me, my neshama, would have you always still has a connection there, even if it's via negativa, even if it's by, you know, as they say that the bull is greater than the donkey, because the donkey just doesn't care, just sitting there stubborn, doesn't move. The bull at least is going and attacking and running and trying to gore you. It's alive. So whether I fully agree with it or not, at least I'm in an engaged dialogue with my past.
Well, listen, this has been a very interesting conversation, and I wish you luck with the projects that you are engaged in.
Yeah, thank you. And anyone out there who's interested in film, Yiddish film or theater, certainly, hopefully in the future, near future, they'll hope to make what they call movie magic or theater, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Baruch.
Yeah.
And folks, we are about to send you out with the rest of whiskey. So here you go. Okay.
Yeah.
Are we going to listen to the concert? It's still not on the radio. You want to listen after a while? Or have you had enough?
To try to make a match between my father and mother. Talked and they talked, but they didn't agree. Until someone produced a bottle of whiskey. Then they drank and they sang and they danced and they reeled. And in the morning when they woke up, the tear was seen. The wedding, the couple was shy, but fortunately, there was an open bar with plenty of whiskey. That's the reason for my insistence. And whiskey is responsible for my very existence. They drank and they danced and they suddenly knew what a young couple is supposed to do. In the beginning, by the circumcision, everybody drank like Russians. So in the end, they put me in the land. I want you to bury me with a
California. Yeah, we're